House Committee on Rules to order for Thursday, March 9th, 2017. I'm going to open a work session for the introduction of a committee measure.
Madam Chair, I move LC 3492, which is introduced at the request of the House Committee on Veteran Services and Emergency Preparedness, be introduced as a committee measure.
Vice Chair McClain moves LC 3492 be introduced as a committee member. And I will say, colleagues, that this was a bill that got caught in a timing issue. So they passed it out of the Veterans Committee, but it didn't make it to the clerk's office in time. There was some confusion, and so we agreed to take that, reintroduce it as a rules bill so that the bill didn't die because of timing. So that's what we're doing here today. Any further discussion? Are there any objections? Not LC is introduced. I'm going to close that work session. I am going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3062 and open a public hearing on House Concurrent Resolution 13.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3062 recognizes April 6th of each year as National Tartan Day in Oregon, and House Concurrent Resolution 13 recognizes and designates the official tartan of the state of Oregon.
Representative Doherty, you want to come on down? Oh, we'll do it all at once. So however you want to do it.
Where do you want me to sit?
Come on up.
Right,
yep.
Well, actually, I will start out with the Tartan Bill. And my name is, for the record, is Representative Margaret Doherty. I'm the state representative from House District 35, which is Tigard in Southwest Portland. And we have two issues before you today. One is to declare officially the Oregon State Tartan, and the other is to declare April 6th Oregon State Tartan Day. So I will start out with the Oregon State Tartan. And as I say, I'm Margaret Doherty from Southwest Portland and Tigard. And official state symbols have played a very important role in recognizing the important contributions made by Oregonians and the great folks that call this our beautiful state home. In Oregon, we have recognized a variety of symbols of significance and importance, including the state mushroom, the state rock, the state nut, the state microbe, fruit, crustacean, beverage, fish, dance, and of course our beloved state animal, the American beaver. Now the time has finally come for Oregon to officially recognize the rich history and contributions of Oregons of Scottish and Irish descent by officially adding the Oregon tartan as official symbol. One important contribution that comes to mind is from David Douglas, a Scottish botanist who the Oregon state tree, the Douglas fir, shares its name. Or maybe you've heard of John McLaughlin, the official father of the state of Oregon, also of Scottish descent. Currently, the Scottish Registry of Tartans has already recognized an official tartan for the state of Oregon, so it is appropriate that Oregon also officially recognize her own tartan. The tartan recognized by the Scottish Registry of Tartans and the one we will propose we officially recognize in Oregon truly is an emblematic of Oregon and our gorgeous landscape. And I'll go to and talk about the tartan colors, and then in a few minutes you will hear from the person that designed it. But the blue representing the blue flag of Oregon, the deep blue waters of the ocean. In fact, this is the Oregon State Tartan.
A model, come on down.
The gold representing the center color of the flag of Oregon, and the many and varied agricultural regions of the state. The green representing the many and varied forests. The white represents the beautiful snow-capped mountains. The taupe representing the high desert and grasslands. The crimson representing the fiery volcanic past and the cinder buttes. The azure representing the streams and creeks and wetland marshes, the shallow lakes, and the wide sweep of the Oregon skies. And the black representing our obsidian buttes. To close, I would like to thank Rob McGregor of the High Desert Celtic Society and the New Caledonian Society of Bend for designing such a beautiful representation of Oregon in this tartan, and I urge you to vote for in support of HCR 13.
Thank you. Thank you. I am Larry Bardell from Albany.
I'm president of the Oregon Scottish Society, and I'm also colonel and commander of the Northwest Scots Guard. And I'm here in representing a plea for a Oregon National Tartan Day. There are a number of reasons why we think this is important. I can skip over all of the contributions that Scottish people have made to the state of Oregon. The first Scottish immigrants into Oregon came in 1821 as part of the Hudson Bay Company, and they settled in this area and established a number of cities, including Dundee, which is west of Portland. The gentleman there, a William Reed, actually established one of the first railroads in Oregon, which today is being run by Southern Pacific. East of here is a village called, or little unincorporated community called McClay. William McClay was also a partner with Mr. Reed in this railroad establishment. We're all familiar with Dr. John McLaughlin. In 1824, I believe, the Hudson Bay established Fort Vancouver, and they placed Dr. William McLaughlin as the overseer of that, and of course he is the one who established Oregon City. So I could go on about a number of contributions that Scottish people have made, but beyond that, there are some other reasons why it would be good for us to celebrate a National Tartan Day. It could be a day when Oregonians of Scottish descent can wear their kilts and tartans with pride to reflect their ancestry, providing an opportunity to tell their story and the history of Scottish people in Oregon. It could be a special day of recognition for Scots that will hopefully diminish some of the stigma of wearing a kilt. Wearing my kilt today, I got whistled at. I got asked, what's it like to wear a skirt? Hopefully, if we would have our own day officially recognized by the state of Oregon, it is recognized nationally, as you know, maybe that would lower some of the stigma and the ridicule. I know a lot of men who have kilts, but they're reluctant to wear it in public for those very reasons. It could be a day set aside when clans and people of Scottish descent can gather together for celebration and fellowship around their family heritage. It could be a day, in addition to the Celtic festivals, which already occur throughout the state, when special events and public gatherings can be arranged for the purpose of providing Scottish entertainment or educational presentations. It could be a day when the 1998 actions of the 105th U.S. Congress and the 2008 presidential proclamation by W. George Bush to establish an annual National Tartan Day can become a reality in Oregon. I see a number of benefits for Oregonians to do this. There could be an improved awareness through information and education. Perhaps some potential for increased tourism if this is to be developed and become an annual event that people look forward to. It's an event for family and community connections. And it's an acknowledgement of the contributions of the many cultural entities in Oregon. You know, a number of other entities already have their day or month or week, and it would be good if people of Scottish descent could also have their day. So I'm hoping and encouraging that the National Tartan Day can be made an annual observance in the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Rayfield.
And just first, I wanted to apologize for my colleague, Representative Doherty, asking you what it feels like to wear a skirt. I think that that is inappropriate.
Yes. I know better.
What kind of harassment is that?
I was doing a little research about tartans last night on Wikipedia, and no respect, I'm like the Rodney Dangerfield of the legislature. And what I was curious about is I found out that there's this thing of tartan etiquette, and that if you're not from a certain clan or a certain area, that you are not supposed to wear that certain type of tartan. That is the etiquette behind that. Mm-hmm. And so is this intended to be a universal or a free tartan, the Oregon tartan that we're looking at here?
Chair Williamson, Vice Chair McLean, and Vice Chair Rayfield, I think that it would be something of a matter of pride, and that everybody, no matter what their clan is, would be able to wear this. I'm not up on my tartan or on my kilt etiquette, but I am sure that it would be something that would pass, and it might be something that some of my colleagues that are going to be up here testifying in a moment will be able to enlighten you on.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a clarification and a follow-up from Representative Rayfield's question. So somebody of Welsh descent could wear the Oregon tartan?
I would say yes. You know, getting back to your question, it goes the full range. If you go to a Celtic or Scottish festival, there are the very diehard who said, no, you cannot wear a kilt unless it's registered with your clan, and mm-hmm. only that clan kilt. And then you go to the other extreme, where they're very free, and they say anything goes. So it's a full range. And I would see no trouble with the Oregon kilt mm-hmm. being worn by anyone, Scots or not. I'm president of the Oregon Scottish Society. I'm a colonel with the Oregon Northwest Scots Guard. I'm French. So there's a lot of lenience.
Actually, I would say that there are some that say the original, the derivative of tartan actually came from the French language.
Some would say that.
Yeah, Wikipedia specifically.
Excellent. Thank you.
Very much. Right.
So David Edelson, Robert McGregor, and Darren Campbell, come on down. And we have both bills open, so. Whichever order you'd like, just be sure to say your name for the record.
Good afternoon. I thank you all for allowing us to be here. My name is Robert McGregor. I'm out of, I'm quite literally between Waldport and Yahats, Oregon. Right. Thank you.
Go ahead. You can.
Do you have anything else to
testify?
Say?
Testify.
What else? Oh, okay. Okay, I'll give a summary on the tartan. I apologize.
Oh, no.
I'm out of my element here. It all came about approximately 1999. I went to a family reunion, and I teach heraldry. Celtic names, predominantly Western European. That's kind of my hobby. So as I was doing this family reunion, all my family knows that I got this weirdness for names and its origin. So they started asking me questions, and it boiled down to, well, we got all these different families. How come we don't have an Oregon one? Washington has theirs. Idaho has one. California, of course, they got to have five. Nevada has one, and we were the only one that didn't have anything representative of the state. And so in my head, I had heard at that time that somebody was trying to design an Oregon State tartan. I never met the person. I don't know if this is true or not. It was rumored. So I went back to the High Desert Celtic Society, and at the time we had a president there, and I suggested that I would like to make a tartan design for contemplation, and he told me to go for it. So I quite literally, it started off with crayons. So he asked me to try to get together around a computer and figure it out. And so we did. Then he asked me for variations, so in a way I kind of got duped into this. So I made four variations, two of the same color scheme. This was my second choice. My first choice was actually voted in second. So what we did was at the High Desert Celtic Festival, and at that time it was Prineville, Oregon, we put all the different variations up for vote, and the different folks there that came in from the different Celtic societies across the state of Oregon, this was the one that they voted on overwhelmingly. And so I was kind of bummed out because my first choice, I didn't meet the mark. But from there, it's been an interesting ride. That's where Mr. Edelstein comes in. I believe it was 2001. We were going to a rugby match. He asked me how it was going. I said, well, yeah, they all voted it in. From here, I don't know what to do. He's like, hey, well, can I help you? And from there, his expertise in this world definitely helped propel it to more of a wider stage. Sir?
Then you want to pick up the story from there?
My name is David Edelstein. I'm a graduate of the Royal Military Academy, which is the United Kingdom's equivalent of West Point. I'm a veteran of the British Army and a member of the Ben Band of Brothers. And thank you for allowing us to come here and testify. There's some different clans that we have here today, but I'm sure that the Vice Chair will agree with me that the Clan MacLean, of which I am a member, is the greatest clan of all, of course. We just cannot resist getting that in, of course.
Surely you could do better.
It was interesting meeting Robbie when I first came up to Ben from Scottsdale when we arrived in 2000. And Robbie has described the inception of the Oregon Tartan very, very well. And in keeping with what Central Oregon and Bend is famous for, he finished the final draft of the Oregon Tartan with me, and we were sipping pints of beer in a brew pub. And I think the result of that is fairly evident with what he has here. I think that it's very, very important, again, which has been stated by Representative Doherty, that we have an Oregon Tartan that represents fluently the Oregon itself and what it's all about. The Tartans go back thousands of years, and if I can just stand up for you for just a moment, they have a long and varied history. This is the official tartan of the Clan MacLean. And it came into being, and we know it's the oldest tartan in Scotland, the oldest known tartan in Scotland, because in 1296, a MacDonald chief owed 12 ells of cloth to a MacLean. And the MacLean stated that it had to have a certain pattern, and the debt was paid by the MacLean tartan being handed to the chief of the MacLean clan, and this is the result of it. The tartans that we have in these days, they tend to be much brighter in color because we use chemical dyes on it, whereas in the older days, in the 1700s, 1800s, 1600s, the tartans were made by the ladies of the clan on a spinning wheel, and they used the local vegetation from the area to put the dyes into the tartan itself. There is no actual law that says nobody can wear a tartan that's other than their clan at all. I would be proud if an Italian with the name of Musiello actually wore my tartan to a tartan at Highland Games. So I would really love to have an official tartan of the state of Oregon enshrined. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Darren.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Darren Campbell, and I'm here today to represent the Clan Campbell, which immediately comes to mind, harasses you all on a daily basis on a number of issues. I try not to be one of those brothers, but I do have a couple. And in my brother Craig's place today, because he has been at home with the flu, he's very remiss that he cannot be here today to speak on this, because he is the family expert on our clan history. I did want to address Representative Holvey's question in regards to wearing other tartans. I today was torn between wearing the one that I wear to Oregon Duck games in honor of their great victory this afternoon at the Pac-12 championship tournament, but chose to go with the Clan Campbell tartan. I wanted to just speak real quickly to our clan. They came to the United States in 1727. We had a colonel in the Revolutionary War who fought on behalf of what became the United States. In the Civil War, we had a captain. The commitment to service from the Scottish Klansmen who came to the United States is great. My father, for example, who spent 18 years in the State House here, is an excellent example of a commitment to service. I believe that having a state tartan, something that every Oregonian can be proud of and take ownership of, is, in these times of divisiveness, a great unifier, something that we can all take part in and take pride in. And with that, I will just say, great bill, please do pass.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes, Representative McClain.
I just wanted to follow up. So was Prineville the location of when our state tartan was chosen?
Yes. It was voted in at the pub.
So at the pub in Prineville?
Representations of what could have been a tartan. Yes, so Prineville would have been the...
I'm so proud of House District 55 that... So I'm just very thrilled about that. I didn't know that. I will, because I love the design. Really impressed. Hadn't seen it till today. The fact that it was even chosen in Prineville, it makes it all the more special. The second point, Madam Chair, I'd love to point out is that it's good to see Clan McLean and Clan Campbell sitting next to each other, because as we all know, the separation, the fight between those clans led to the different sides on the Scottish Civil War and the Battle of Culloden of 1742, where the Campbells, siding with the English, actually overran the McLean clan, and we had to flee to the colonies. But I digress. But it's just good to see that after 270 years, you guys were together again.
We're working it out. It takes
that long for a good Scot to put away a grudge. But you know what? Good on you for doing it. Thank you, sir. Wonderful design.
Any other questions, comments? Well, I echo Vice Chair McClain. That is a beautiful design, and I hope that the folks who run our gift shop are watching, and they will soon get some Oregon tartan up in the gift shop. So thank you, Representative Doherty, for bringing these. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on HCR 13 and close the public hearing on House Bill 3062. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2702.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2702 requires communications made in support or opposition to candidate or measure identify whether candidate, petition committee, or political committee authorized the communication. You do have before you for your consideration -1 amendments, which remove application of identification requirement to measures. I will point out the -3 do that as well. And then you also have the -2, which adds to exemptions radio or television advertisements that have a fair market value of less than $500.
Chair Williamson, members of the committee, Dan Rayfield, House District 16, and with me is Representative Kenemer. Both of us sat on the campaign finance task force together, and this was a bill that really was somewhat I brought to our attention at that time, and we both said, hey, what the heck, let's go ahead and draft this bill and bring it forward. Very simply put, Oregon is one of the last remaining states not to have disclaimer requirements on campaign ads for state and local offices. Essentially, you know, part of the problem that this tries to solve is you get a lot of mail from political sides, and voters need to know what to trust. And so this is something that allows them to get access to more information to verify what's going on. Without these types of ads, it's easier to distribute anonymous attack ads. you were also prevented from knowing who's attempting to influence our elections. And it's also difficult to hold people accountable when they send dishonest statements. And so that's what this is really aimed at doing. We've had some recent examples in history where having a statement on there, whether this was approved by the candidate or whether this was not approved by the candidate in some local elections, would have been helpful to the voters in those districts. And simply put, that's what the ad does, is it requires candidates to state whether this is approved by them. And if it's other folks, they would say that it is not approved. And there is a, I believe it's a -3 amendment, which removes ballot measures from the actual language, the current bill as drafted. And so I'll turn it over at that point.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Bill Kenemer, State Representative, District 39. I joined in supporting it. It was interesting to be on the task force and to talk about this. And I guess a couple of things in background. First of all candidates for federal office in Oregon already have to follow disclaimer requirements. But some candidate groups refuse to be accountable for their ads, and House Bill 2702 eliminates that loophole in the Oregon laws and makes sure that everybody follows the same rules. The task force in discussing this was almost unanimous, but not quite, but close. We were close. There was a strong support for it. I guess also in doing in looking at some polling, Americans across the political spectrum support strong disclosure laws. Recent polls show that the vast majority of Republicans, Democrats, and Independents support strong transparency laws that allow voters to know who is funding secret money political groups and campaigns. And frankly, I think disclosure is common sense, nonpartisan or bipartisan reform that can allow voters to know who is trying to influence our elections. 46 states and the federal government require disclaimer statements on their ads. 46, so I think we ought to join them. And in the 2016 general election, 89% of Multnomah County voters voted for a law to require disclaimer statements on political ads. You know, I think all of us as voters have found that we tend to evaluate ads differently based on the sponsors of a given message. And I think voters have the right to know who is creating the message. Another piece that is fundamental is that a healthy democracy, I think, demands accountability. And I think most of us have probably, or at least a good many, have experienced attack ads that are anonymous and secretive. And I think they hurt the public discourse and the integrity of our elections. If a candidate's ad is untruthful or misleading, the voter should have the right to hold that candidate accountable. Voters in 46 other states have that right. And I guess I would conclude by saying, I think that with freedom comes responsibility, and with the freedom of speech, there is the responsibility to accept responsibility for giving that speech.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things I don't see that I'm just curious about is, what about in-kind? So it talks a lot about contributions, who it's paid for by, pretty specific about that, but there's nothing in here that says any entity or anyone who gives an in-kind contribution will have to be accounted for.
And again, it would go down to the fact is, if you're a candidate, if it's coming from the candidate, so generally if it's an in-kind, that's probably going to come through the candidate, or there's going to be that coordination between the two, and at that point you would then, I assume, I'm trying to think of a good example of how that would work. Let's say that because Representative Hack, you're very supportive of my campaigns, you know, and we're very bipartisan, and our support for each other. You decided to do an in-kind ad for me in my district, and you paid for it. Because it's in-kind, that would assume there's some coordination. So I would the way that you would apply that, I think, would be talking to me, and then it would be either this content was approved by the candidate or was not authorized by the candidate. And you would just make that disclosure at that time on whatever ad that that you were sending. So it'd be the it, almost very similar to the way an independent expenditure or anything else going on in the community.
So will it show the in-kind entity that produced the ad or paid for the ad, or will it simply say that the ad was approved by the candidate or not approved by the candidate, but won't say where it came from?
It'll just say, yeah, so exactly. So their anonymous speech can still occur. Because those are some of the constitutional provisions that we do have. It'll just say whether the communication was authorized or not authorized by the candidate themselves.
One more follow-up. Thank you. So is there a size of font that this has to be put in on the print ad? I mean, if it essentially could be size 2 or 3 font and be buried and no one would ever know, and it really wouldn't have much effect one way or another.
And I believe it has to be just clearly identified on the bill, but I don't think.
Section 4.
I was looking at it.
Sorry, we needed a little help on that.
Phone a friend.
I didn't in
the Secretary of State?
Yeah, so Secretary of State shall prescribe the form of the statements required on the communications as described in this section. And so that's why it says it clearly identified has the meaning.
Thank you, Chair. If an entity is found to have printed an ad against a candidate without the candidate's authorization or not, and it's not printed on an ad, what would be the recourse? Is there a penalty for that? It's one thing to put it into law to say don't do it, which I'm supportive. Trust me, I'm not going against what you're trying to do. I'm just trying to clarify what would be the ramification to someone for just doing it anyway.
That's a good question. I don't think that this bill necessarily hits that, although the question that I would have in the back of my head is whether this falls under the Secretary of State's already ability to levy civil penalties under situations like this. And so that would be what, but I don't know that for sure.
And I don't know if you...
Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, generally.
So, because I know... sometimes what happens is there's a postage meter that's buried under this person's name that goes to this entity, to that entity, and it takes a lot of work to figure out where a mailer came from to begin with. And then to hold that entity responsible is virtually, I mean, I just don't know. I'm just trying to see where the teeth would be if we were to, I mean, I think this is good. I'm just trying to see if there's a possibility that we might be able to put some teeth in it so that we keep them from actually going around it and doing it anyway.
Excuse me, just one more addition. Daniel Lukau is going to be speaking. We've worked with him in Common Cause, and he may have some additional information about it. So in a few moments.
To follow up Representative Hack's question, it does seem to me, Representative Rayfield and Kenward, that ads which don't say where they're from are hit ads. And they're not going to have any coordination. And if they do, the purpose of not putting your name and not, you know, approving all that stuff, these guys fly under the radar. And I know Ms. Hack has, and others that I know have endured hit ads, negative ads, that contained information that was false and, based on my understanding, was knowingly false. And yet, and then there's no identification of who they are or all that kind of stuff. Now, is that what you're trying to prevent? Because if it's, I guess the question is, because speak to the negative aspect, how do you police it when it's a hit?
So there's a, if you have an attack ad that say a candidate was sending or going forward, or if you had just any ad coming from a candidate, that ad would then specify whether that was authorized by the candidate or was not authorized. But, you know, obviously it's coming from the candidate. That's the way that they're going to respond. And so any other entity outside of that, if they were doing an attack ad, would have to do the same thing. So if they were not coordinating, it would be not authorized by that candidate. So I don't think, I mean, it's in any solution, given the way that our Constitution is, there is not a perfect fix. I think in a perfect world, the way that things are, we would more adhere to where the federal side is. What we want to do is get at the real underlying problem of trying to give voters more information about the about what they're receiving in the mail to kind of reduce on some of, give more clarity. And some of the folks that send information, we're not really sure what information to trust or not to trust as people try and skirt these rules. And so that's what this is really aimed at. I don't think we're saying that this is a perfect fix by any stretch of the means.
All right. Thank you. We have testimony coming in over the phone.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I was just wondering, thank you, Madam Chair, just wondering what the discussion was around the Dash 3 amendment and not having this apply to measures. Is it because they're already covered?
Chair Williamson, Representative Holby, we really want to focus more on candidates. And so if you were to say this was approved by a measure committee, it was just cleaner making this about candidates. And that's really where we've seen, I think a problem that's easier to identify and address.
And if I may add, Madam Chair, I think also part of it is that it's separate statutes for measures. And so that was one of the other complications.
All right, thank you. Hi, this is Chair Williamson. Do we have Austin, Tara, and Holly on the phone? And Matt?
Chair Williamson, yes. This is Austin Graham from the Campaign Legal Center.
Excellent. Go right ahead in any order you want. Just be sure to identify yourself.
Great. Okay. Thank you, Chair Williamson. So my name is Austin Graham. I'm Associate Counsel with the Campaign Legal Center. I'm joined by my colleague, Tara Malloy. She's our Deputy Executive Director. I'll give a little background about the Campaign Legal Center in case anyone's not familiar with us. So Campaign Legal Center, or CLC, is a nonpartisan group. And our mission is to improve democracy and protect the right of Americans to participate in the political process. Particularly, we help to conceptualize and draft and enforce and defend laws in the areas of campaign finance, ethics and lobbying, voting rights, and redistricting. I'm calling in today to discuss how federal courts assess the constitutionality of political advertising disclaimers under the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. So federal courts, including the United States Supreme Court and the Ninth Circuit, consider disclosure and disclaimer laws in particular to be a less restrictive method of campaign finance regulation than contribution and expenditure limits. This is because disclosure doesn't actually limit political speech and actually provides information to voters that helps inform their choices. When federal courts look at the constitutionality of disclosure requirements, they use a less rigorous standard of review than the scrutiny applied to contribution and expenditure limits. Though courts require disclaimers to have a substantial relation to a sufficiently important government interest, courts have consistently held that disclaimers advance a sufficiently important interest in informing voters about the sources behind political messaging and ultimately helping voters make more informed choices in the political marketplace. In addition to informing voters, disclosure helps to reduce a risk of corruption by giving the public information about sources supporting candidates and elected officials. Further, by creating a paper trail, disclosure helps to ensure enforcement of contribution limits and other campaign finance regulations. The Supreme Court has consistently upheld the constitutionality of the federal disclaimer law's application to electioneering communications which are political advertisements that reference candidates but do not expressly advocate the candidate's election or defeat. In Citizens United, the Supreme Court held application of disclaimers to a video-on-demand documentary and commercial advertisements promoting the film was constitutional. Essentially, the court believed that the public's right to know about who is publicly speaking about a presidential candidate shortly before an election justified requiring disclaimers on commercials asking people to go see a movie. The Ninth Circuit has followed the Supreme Court in upholding broad disclaimer laws. Since Citizens United, the Ninth Circuit has upheld the constitutionality of Hawaii and Washington State's political advertising disclaimer laws, both of which have a broader reach than HB 2702. The Ninth Circuit cited disclaimers' provision of information to voters as the sufficiently important interest justifying public identification behind political messages. HB 2702 imposes modest requirements that political advertisements indicate whether a candidate has authorized the advertisement. The Supreme Court and Ninth Circuit have upheld much broader laws as constitutional under the First Amendment. CLC has little difficulty concluding that a court would find HB 2702 was constitutional under the First Amendment because of the information it could provide to Oregon voters about the sources behind political messages. I'll open it up to any questions you have about either the memo we submitted or the federal jurisprudence on political advertising disclaimers and disclosure more generally.
Questions?
Sure.
Oh, we don't have any, so thank you very much.
Great, thank you.
All right, who else is on the line?
Hello, Chair Williamson. This is Matthew Tomlinson and Holly Pettit. We're both attorneys at Hart Wagner in Portland.
Hi, welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we were asked to look into whether HB 2702 is constitutional under Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution. And as you may know, that is Oregon's version of the free speech provision. It's worded somewhat differently than the First Amendment. It has been interpreted somewhat differently. The text of the constitutional provision provides that, quote, no law shall be passed restraining the free expression of opinion or restricting the right to speak, write, or print freely on any subject whatever, but every person shall be responsible for the abuse of that right. And so that's the text of the provision. And if you just look at the text alone, in our view, a limited disclosure statute like HB 2702 does not violate that text. It does not restrict the right of anyone to speak on any subject. It does not affect most anonymous speech, except perhaps by candidates themselves. And so we think the burden on speech is very limited, if at all. That said, we are unaware of any case in Oregon that addresses a statute like HB 2702. So this is what we call an issue of first impression. And so it becomes difficult to predict how a court would rule on such a provision. And so we must ask first, what would be the methodology by which a court would review a statute like HB 2702? The common methodology for interpreting a statute under Article 1, Section 8 is what we call the State versus Robertson methodology. And I think there is some question as to that would even apply in a case such as this one when it's just a disclosure statute, but let's assume that it will. And so what State versus Robertson says is a law that is directed at the content of speech is generally unconstitutional unless it falls within a historical exception. And what the courts mean by historical exceptions is if there's some exception that applied at common law, really when the Oregon Constitution was adopted, that would show an intent by the founding fathers to remove that restriction from speech from Article 1, Section 8. So one example we often see is fraud. You know, fraud is speech, and a limitation on fraud is a limitation on speech, the state has always limited fraud, so that is a historical exception. So that's the first level, what we call the first level of the Robertson methodology. And again, that means if the law is directed at the content of speech, it's unconstitutional unless it falls within a historical exception. If the law is directed at what they call forbidden results, And even if it's directed at speech, then what the court would do is look to see whether it's too broad. So a law that would be directed at forbidden results would be a law that says, you know, you can't mislead somebody. That's more concerned with the result. And even though that impacts speech, we look at it under this second level of the Robertson methodology. And then there's a third level, which is more ad hoc, and it gets complicated, and it's really not relevant for our purposes, so we'll just stick with the first two. And so if State versus Robertson applies, and it likely does, we do agree that this would fall under the first level, which means it is a law that targets a certain content of speech, in this case, political speech. So this would be a first category law. However, we do have laws on the books in Oregon that regulate misleading political speech. And the case that we often see cited for that proposition is called State versus Moyer. And State versus Moyer dealt with a statute that prohibits someone making a campaign contribution other than in the name of the person who in truth provides the contribution. And what the court said in that case is, quote, prohibiting the concealment of the identity of the true provider of a political contribution, the public or both, is, we conclude, an extension or modern variant of the initial principle that underlies the historic legal prohibition against deceptive or misleading expression. But we do believe that this law, HB 2702, could likely fall under that exception. So even though it is directed at content, it seems to us to be designed at prohibiting misleading advertisements, advertisements where things are possibly falsely attributed between candidates. And while we have not done a historical analysis, if the purpose for this law is to fall under that exception, then it could be constitutional. Now, we have to emphasize, because we're dealing with Article 1, Section 8, and this is an issue of first impression, it is simply impossible to provide certainty on this issue. But we do think that there is a strong argument that this statute, even though it's directed at political speech, would fall within that exception and would therefore be constitutional. And I open up to the questions if you have any.
Yes, Representative Kenemer.
Thank you. Thank you. And I guess the question that I would have is the person who spoke before you talked about also by giving the person who created or paid for the statement is also additional information. Would you concur with that?
Could you
Chair Williamson, yeah. Representative Kenemer, I'm sorry, I had trouble hearing what you said. Could you repeat yourself?
Yeah, my apology. I'll get closer to the mic. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. What I was pointing out is the person who spoke before you talked about, in addition, the notice of who paid for it was actually the provision of even more information. So, again, it was legitimate under freedom of speech. Would you concur with that analysis?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Rayfield.
And I just wanted to get a quick answer to a couple of the panel members just really quickly. So it's more of just a quick comment. The answer about how this would be enforced and just kind of quickly checking, and kind of my assumption was there is a civil penalties portion within our statutes that this would fall under that already exists. And so that is the case. And so that's how this would be enforced. The other thing to do would give you guys a little bit better of an idea of how this would work. So if you sent out a communication from you or your PAC, you would have a statement at the bottom of your advertisement that would say, Dan Rayfield authorized this communication. If it was sent from another PAC that was not associated from you or associated with you but was about you, PAC would then have to say whether that was authorized by any candidate. And so most likely that is going to be this communication was not authorized by any candidate. And then the same would go for an independent expenditure, whether it was for or in opposition of a candidate, that would be sent out. And because an independent expenditure by its very own nature is not going to be approved, there is no coordination in that way, it will say that this communication was not authorized by any candidate, just by the pure definition of an independent expenditure. So I just wanted to kind of clear that up and give you kind of a couple of mental examples of what that would look like in your mailbox.
So, thank you, Chair. Just a question as it relates to that. Then there's technically no accountability for who's sending it out, essentially, then. So it's not going to say in-kind contribution, paid for by in-kind contribution from so-and-so, paid for by so-and-so. Because isn't there something now that already we have to do some of that, but it's not happening? I mean, I'm...
It's so Chair Williamson, Representative Hack, so it's two different issues. One is going to be the trust of the voters, and that we want to make sure that the voters have the adequate information so that they can see where this information, is this authorized by a candidate, who is speaking, what information should we trust. As far as you're thinking of a paid for by disclosure,
both.
So this is not a paid for by type of thing. So if you wanted to find out who paid for something, you could go on to OrStar and then from there track down the expenditure and where that was made. So for independent expenditures, it would be $750 for an individual, and you can actually search that and what campaign that was going. And that's how you would obtain information along those lines. In some cases, though, you're not going to be able to find out if it was a PAC that made an expenditure and it wasn't in, I mean, I guess it would be an independent expenditure, not an in-kind. If it was an in-kind from another PAC, then it would be registered on the one candidate's PAC through OrStar. So all the paid for by stuff would be tracked in OrStar. This is really more focused on giving voters information so that they can make better decisions as voters. As we've seen, there have been some misleading communication that's gone out, and had voters had this information, it would have been very helpful.
Additional questions, Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going back to Representative McLean's question about a hit ad. So you said it has to say it's authorized by, but if it's a private party that does a hit ad, it's not authorized by the candidate. Do they then have to specify this was authorized by that individual, or do they just leave it off?
That's what I'm
doing. So Chair Williamson, Representative Barreto. So if someone sent an independent committee sent an attack ad against Representative Noce, as they do every election, this ad at the bottom, and if it wasn't associated with any candidate, this is an independent group, it would say not authorized by, it wouldn't say not, the content or the communication, what's the language, the communication was not authorized by any candidate. That's all it would say at the very bottom of it. Now, if it was coming from the a candidate's committee in support or opposition, then it would be this candidate, authorizes communication.
Any other questions for folks on the phone? All right. Thank you all for being with us. Can hang up the phone, right? And thanks.
Thank you.
And if Daniel and Norm and Sal, you want to testify as well, come on down.
So, Chair, can I just ask a question of probably either Dan or Bill? So if you think about it this way, what keeps a candidate from not wanting that to be, because they don't want their name on it. So they'd be more than happy to put that on there to say, I didn't have anything to do with it. Go ahead and hit them all day long. So to me, that's almost like saying, way to go. We're giving them a free ride to say in big, bold print, I had nothing to do with this. I think the bigger issue here is to have accountability on who actually sent it, which is what I was trying to get at. To say, we want to know who sent this ad out. Right. So to me, the bigger question here is holding the individual committee, PAC, group, whoever that sent it out. Because to me, I mean, if you're going to send a hit out and you get to disclose on there that the candidate had nothing to do with it, they're going to go, woohoo, sign me up. So would you be willing to look at something that amends this to say, we want you to disclose where it came from? Because to me, that's the issue. It's not about whether or not the candidate endorsed it, because what are they, I mean, if it's a hit ad, they don't want their name on it anyway.
Chair Williamson, Representative Hack, the paid for by disclosures, which is what you're basically talking about, who it's coming from, that is under the Oregon Constitution what we talk about as not being able to do. So this is a different way at kind of getting at an issue for voters so that they can have some trust in the communication that they're receiving. And so that our Oregon Constitution is more restrictive than the federal Constitution under these situations. So paid for by type disclosures right now are not constitutional in Oregon. At least that's what some legal scholars think. This solution, as we talk about, to give more information to voters so that they know which information to trust, is by, as you just heard from the legal scholar's point of view, would be considered constitutional.
Can I have a follow-up?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Chair. So what about in-kind? Is it saying in the Constitution that you can't ask who does it by in-kind? Not paid for, but an in-kind donation? Because he talked about paid for, but he didn't address the in-kind issue.
Yeah, so, yeah, Chair Williamson, Representative Fackett, would probably be treated the same way, just because of the nature that it is considered, you know, where, because okay. You're telling it, you're basically pointing out where it came from. So.
Thank you.
All right, go ahead.
Chair Williamson, members of the House Rules Committee, my name is Daniel Lukow, and I'm the political director of Common Cause Oregon. We're a nonpartisan organization that advocates for openness in our democracy, fairness in our elections, and accountability in our government. And we urge you to pass House Bill 2702. HB 2702 requires that campaign ads identify whether they have been authorized by a candidate. If a candidate sends out an ad, then the candidate must state that he or she has approved and authorized the ad. And if an organization sends out an ad that has not been authorized by a candidate, like an independent expenditure, then they must state that fact on the ad. This is more commonly called a disclaimer law, and 46 other states and the federal government have adopted them as common sense solution to secretive, unaccountable campaign ads. There are several important benefits for passing HB 2702. The first is to reduce the distribution of false and misleading ads. This is a growing issue here in Oregon. For instance, in the 2016 primary election, someone sent out a fake voters pamphlet to voters in House District 44 with a message that appeared to be authorized by Speaker Tina Kotek, who was running for her party's nomination. The ad provided misleading information about her while implying that she had authorized the ad. Voters are misled about whether the ad came from Speaker Kotek, her opponent, or a third-party organization. You could see fake ad in the material section of OLIS. And while this example affected a specific district, the problem could affect voters and candidates from any party in any district. False ads like these are concerning. They challenge the integrity of our elections if third-party organizations can impersonate candidates, or if one candidate can impersonate another candidate. These false and misleading ads make it difficult for voters to evaluate the information that they receive during an election. HB 2702 addresses this problem with a simple and direct manner. If we require ads to state whether they were or were not authorized by a candidate, then we can give voters information about who's responsible for the message. The second reason is that candidates should stand by their messages. Candidates have a right to say what they choose in any election. But voters also have a right to hold a candidate accountable for false or misleading statements. Voters in Oregon deserve to have the same tools to evaluate campaign messages that voters in 46 other states have. The final point I'd like to say is that reform ensures that everyone follows the same rules. Oregon's candidates for Congress have to follow federal disclaimer laws, and many of the candidates for state office choose to include disclaimers on their ads. But some candidates and groups refuse to be accountable for their ads, and HB 2702 eliminates the loophole in our laws and makes sure that everyone follows the same rules. HB 2702 is a straightforward reform that makes sense for Oregon. It reduces false and misleading ads. It gives Oregon voters the same tools that voters in 46 other states have to hold the candidates accountable, and ensures that every candidate plays by the same rules. A healthy democracy needs transparency and accountability. HB 2702 is a proven, simple, bipartisan reform that we can adopt here in Oregon. And Common Cause Oregon urges you to pass this bill. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Chair Williamson and members of the committee, my name is Norman Turrell. I'm the president of the League of Women Voters of Oregon. And I'm also a retired software engineer and a member of the task force for campaign finance reform that the legislature set up. And I've been working on campaign finance reform for some 40 years, and I won't bore you with the rest of my qualifications that I told you the last time I was in front of you. But I'm here in support of HB 2702. The League of Women Voters of Oregon and nationally, the LWVUS, have supported transparency and disclosure of campaign financing of elections with their studies and advocacy positions since the 1970s. HB 2702 would establish disclaimer requirements in ads in Oregon. It requires ads explicitly state whether they were approved or authorized or not by a candidate in the race. Oregon is only one of four remaining states that does not have disclaimer requirements on campaign ads for state and local offices. Without such disclaimers, it is easier to anonymously attack a candidate, and voters may be prevented from knowing who is attempting to influence their vote. It also becomes more difficult for a candidate to control the messaging of their own campaigns. Candidates for federal office in Oregon already have to follow disclaimer requirements, and many candidates voluntarily put disclaimers on their ads, even if they're not federal candidates. But some candidates or groups refuse to be accountable for their ads. HB 2702 eliminates a loophole in our laws and makes sure that everyone follows the same rules. And I wanted to give some further background for Representative Hack, who I guess has left the room. But there used to be a statute in Oregon that required, paid for by disclaimers. And that was ruled in the 1990s by Representative Attorney General Hardy Myers as unconstitutional under the Oregon Constitution. And later the legislature, because of that ruling, repealed that particular statute. However, that ruling has never been challenged in court, and it could be. So if you wanted to go ahead and pass such a law, we could probably do that. But we, at the moment, we're trying to do something that's constitutional for sure, and you can take care of that other one separately. So I wanted to also point out that the Task Force on Campaign Finance Reform, in its report for the legislature, almost unanimously recommended that the legislature should develop constitutional options for disclaimer requirements. Furthermore, if Oregon had contribution limits as recommended by the Task Force on Campaign Finance Reform in its proposed HDR 5, then disclaimers on campaign advertisements would be even more important for Oregon to discourage dark money independent expenditures that try to evade contribution limits. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. And I will just point out we have one more bill to do. I know several of us have to vote in Ways and Means at 4:30, so the committee is going to adjourn at 4:30. So, Sal, go ahead.
Brief, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Sal Peralta. I'm the Secretary of the Independent Party of Oregon. The Independent Party was part of the same work group that these gentlemen participated in. Our member, Rob Harris, is not able to make it today. IPO supports this bill as a incredibly modest incremental improvement over the current Oregon law. I am very sympathetic to Representative Hack and Representative Barreto's comments that we should have more accountability for people who are not candidates who file false statements. I'm especially sympathetic to Representative Hack's comments that this is something that candidates themselves would greatly appreciate to be able to distance themselves from hit pieces. So in that regard, the legislature in passing this legislation would not be moving the ball forward very far. I would say that we strongly disagree with the analysis that disclaimers that require people to accurately identify their source are unconstitutional under Oregon law. The Hardy-Meyers opinion in 1999, every aspect of that opinion has been proven false in federal and state courts that has been litigated to this point. The one aspect that hasn't been litigated is whether or not these paid for by disclosures are constitutional in the state court. Citizens United, as the gentleman from Hart Wagner testified to earlier, firmly upheld disclosure requirements, and State v. Moyer upheld the disclosure requirements for ORSTAR in the state of Oregon. So we think all of the pieces are there for a stronger bill and would encourage the stronger bill. That's the bulk of my testimony. The only other point that I'd make is that one-fifth of Oregon voters living in Multnomah County are already operating under a much stronger regime than what you're proposing here. Multnomah County passed a regulatory system that's much more similar to California or Washington State, which requires not only those disclaimers be printed, but the actual sources of revenue for the disclaimers also be included on the communications. And that passed with 87% of the vote in Multnomah County. So I think this is strongly supported by the public is way ahead of the legislature in this, and I'd encourage you to catch up to them. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Right. Yes, Representative Bredow.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. So, if you said no ads against an opponent unless they're approved by the opposing candidate, is that go against free speech? So, if there's a hit ad like we were talking about, then the candidate basically has to approve that, or they don't run it.
My apologies, Chair Williamson, Representative Bredow. If a hit ad goes out against a candidate, right, and the ad has been authorized by the candidate themselves, or the ad has been authorized by a group coordinating with the candidate, like an in-kind contribution,
right,
then in that case it would just have to say this ad has been authorized by candidate X, and have to name the candidate. If the ad has not been authorized by the candidate, it would have to say this ad has not been authorized by a candidate. And the reason that's really important is because we are seeing a growth in ads that are going out that are impersonating candidates. Like an independent expenditure goes out and claims to be in the voice of a candidate and claims to speak for a candidate, as was the case in House District 44. And so making it clear that a candidate did not authorize the independent expenditure ad makes it clear to voters that this isn't an ad coming from a candidate, that this is not impersonating a candidate.
Okay. Follow up. You know, I'm just thinking the candidate turns their head and says, yeah, I don't want to know what you do, but go ahead and do it. You know, I mean, is it authorized or not authorized? It's still basically subversively giving permission to do it, but they don't want to know anything about it. So that's all I'm saying. So then if an ad goes out, you know, then they either own up to it or it doesn't go out. Or the name of the person or entity that does push the ad is right at the bottom of the page.
Chair Williamson and Representative Bredow, I think you've got it right. At least the voters would know that the campaign ad was not authorized, and then they would not trust that ad as much as they would an authorized ad. This is very light disclosure, but it's a crucial disclosure for the voters.
All right, thank you all very much. I'm gonna close the public hearing on House Bill 2702. I'm gonna open the public hearing on House Bill 2945. Vice Chair Rayfield, you've got the gavel.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2945 requires incumbent state office holder who files for re-election to same office file their nominating petition or declaration of candidacy not later than 77 days before primary election. If the incumbent candidate files for re-election and then withdraws, other candidates may file for office not later than 70 days before date of primary or 3 business days after the date the incumbent has withdrawn its candidacy, whichever is later, extends the deadline for filing voter's pamphlet, portrait, and statement to match candidacy deadline.
Please.
Thank you, Vice Chair Rayfield. My name's Mike McLean, and I am the State Representative from District 55. It's my pleasure to bring this bill with my co-chief sponsor, the chair of our committee, Jennifer Williamson. And we brought House Bill 2945 along with the Republican leader in the Senate, Ted Farioli, and the Democratic leader in the Senate, Jenny Burdick. And the reason the four caucus leaders all signed on as chief sponsors of this bill is that we have had the abuse of incumbency done by Republicans and Democrats over the past series of elections. I haven't really looked that much beyond 10 years, but what we have is last minute pulling out and anointing successors. And it typically comes from somebody not filing and acting like they're running, then all of a sudden announcing that they are not going to run, leaving very little time for folks to file. Or we have someone who does file and pulls out at the last minute. Or like last year, what we had was a coordination between a Senate member and a House member who coordinated together to pull out after the deadline when the replacements that they chose filed 3 minutes before the deadline. As what happens here, when someone takes something too far, and this extreme example, as I just previously mentioned, really does beg for correction. While it was not illegal, I think most consider it completely unethical. And the reason why people have term limit propositions periodically is because it's a recognition that incumbency carries with it power. Power with fundraising, power with recognition in the public, your name ID, et cetera. And so if an incumbent is going to leave, House Bill 2945 gives a time frame in which the public is giving notice of that departure and people are able to compete. Representative Williamson competed in a contested Democratic primary. I competed in a contested Republican primary, and both of us won our primaries after working very hard and went on to win general elections in what are sort of one-sided general elections in our respective districts. But we were given the privilege to compete, and so I think I speak for her when that fair elections and earnest competition in a campaign is a good thing, not a bad thing. And so House Bill 2945 would say two things. If you're not, if you're running for reelection, you need to file 7 days before the deadline so that people know you're in or you're out. And if you do file and you later decide I'm not going to run, then it opens up 3 days. Now, if your 3 days is within 3 days of the deadline, then it actually pushes the deadline out a bit. The reason why I, Jennifer Williamson and I, along with Jenny Burdick and Ted Farioli, like 3 days is that you're bumping up up against a voter's pamphlet publication date. And so if the deadline's at 5 o'clock on Friday, as what happened last year, and then you have someone pull out the next day after the deadline is closed, it would be 3 days from the date of the departure of the incumbent. So technically, the voter's pamphlet publication could come into play here, but I think what's going to happen is we're going to not see such shenanigans by incumbents, and so I'm not worried about that. But that's an essence of this bill. And I'm very grateful to bring it with my colleague and friend, and would urge you to move the bill. And I'm going to defer to my colleague, our chair, who has the power to move this bill. And I admire her and respect what she has to say on the bill.
Thank you, Representative McLean. Vice Chair Rayfield, colleagues Jennifer Williamson, House District 36 in Portland. I am pleased to join the other caucus chairs as chief sponsors of this bill. I think Representative McLean did a good job of summarizing it. This is really about leveling the playing field. We've had this happen in both the House and the Senate and in every caucus, so it really is an issue that we need to deal with. I know that there are folks who want to talk about the 3 days and whether or not that's an appropriate time frame. I know that there are several bills in this committee that deal with time frames, and what will end up happening, I think, is we will end up having to put all the bills out together and look at time frames together. I think Representative McLean did a good job of why we landed as sponsors on 3 days. I know there are others who may testify that they would like a longer period of time. It's just not clear right now depending on what bills pass, what those windows of opportunity will look like when we run up against the short session, when we run up against the voter pamphlet statement, as Representative McLean mentioned, as well as other deadlines that are built into the process. So I think we might both be open to talking about timing. It's just the reality is we've got a whole bunch of bills in this committee that deal with timing, and we'll just have to take a look at that as a much more holistic conversation. So with that, I thank you for your consideration.
Representative Brito.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if they don't withdraw, say there's another primary opponent and it goes into, say, 2 weeks before the ballots drop and then the incumbent pulls out, does someone else have 3 days to jump into the race at that far into the race?
Yeah, Representative Rayfield, our esteemed acting chair, and Representative Brito, yes, even though the nature of having a contested primary would seem to mitigate the harm done to the public, as previous examples exposed, I don't believe having language in there to exempt those deadlines should someone have previously filed. I think in the end it could still lead to gaming of it. I think the issue here is the power of the incumbency, not necessarily declaration of contested primary. So what we want to do is to let the public know, is this race going to contain an incumbent or not? And if it's not going to contain an incumbent, we want to give the public a time to get in for people to make a decision. And so having someone previously in the race taking on an incumbent and the incumbent pulled out, that would extend it under the language of the bill, and I think it should. And if no one else files, then, you know, that's okay, but the public had notice.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Williamson's members of the committee. For the record, Julie Parrish here on House Bill 2945. You might note that my pre-session filed a similar bill, House Bill 2429, and I appreciate anybody who voted yes on the art therapy bill this week, because it will exclude me when you show you the calendar. Rep. Smith Warner the other day asked for calendar, so I mapped one out of why a 3 day is actually doesn't work for this concept and why there is a dash one for 14 days. So House Bill 2945, as proposed, having used March of 2016 election calendar, we filed, our filing deadline was at 5 p.m. on the 8th. Our withdrawal deadline was at 5 p.m. on the 11th. Under this bill, adding 3 days after the withdrawal deadline, if you withdrew on the Wednesday, your filing deadline with 3 business days would be on the 14th. So on and so forth, of the 10th would be the 15th, 11th would be the 16th. By agency rule, I believe, the voter's pamphlet statement is due 2 days after our filing deadline, which is the 68th day. In this bill, though, it's noted that it's a 63rd day. So if you had somebody pull out of the process as an incumbent on the traditional withdrawal deadline day, And then with 3 days, the 63rd day of the voter's pamphlet is actually would have been the 15th of March. So if you had then filed under this three-day bill, you wouldn't get a voter's pamphlet the way this bill is currently drafted. So that's a problem. The other piece that I think is really important, so I sort of drew this out with 14 days. If you go into the next piece, which would have actually put us up into February, and on the previous conversation in a different bill, the concern about we're in session. While I appreciate sort of the pomp and circumstance of how we have a filing deadline, nothing in statute actually says we have to have that ceremony. And other offices are filing all over the state. County commissions have the same deadline we do, and so that isn't necessarily just because we have a nice elaborate thing for filing for legislature. But with 14 days and the modification under, we had discussed previously under House Bill 2428, which is being considered, where, and that was about filing, that bill is about voters pamphlets and being able to gather signatures, and the Secretary of State's office recommended moving the filing deadline back by 10 days, which would have, under 2016 calendar, for the May primary, would have put us at the beginning filing deadline of February 23rd, you could accommodate 14 days. And the reason that's important is in the three-day window, if you think about newspaper deadlines and the media and the ability to actually tell voters that somebody pulled out, a three-day window doesn't let the press write the news. It doesn't actually create an opportunity for somebody to come up as a groundswell candidate from their community. So I've highlighted some dates in these calendars of when Sunday newspapers have their deadlines and when weekly newspapers across the state have deadlines. And you'll notice with my great art therapy of coloring out this calendar for you that if you filed, had somebody pull out like we saw in the last filing session in May of last year, on the Wednesday the 9th, that's the only day that a newspaper publication in the state could actually publish that somebody dropped out of the race. So if our intent is to actually have an opportunity for somebody from the community to come forward and run, 3 days only allows people who are already inside our own echo chamber to then file, and really House members to bounce up to Senate races. It doesn't allow for an opportunity for a Sunday newspaper or a weekly publication. So by looking at 14 days, you actually create a couple weeks worth of news cycles for people to have a chance. You also have some other deadline issues of when you expend money that I think are important. You have a $25 filing fee and a $750 voters pamphlet statement. That triggers the necessity to have a PAC within a certain amount of days. So 3 days is probably not the right number. I'm not necessarily care what vehicle a fix goes out in, because I think we need a fix, otherwise I wouldn't have drafted a fix, but I do think you need to consider that there are other pieces in the deadlines, and 3 days only is still incumbent protection for those of us who already have a PAC open, who've already filed and gathered SEL 400 statements to have a voter's pamphlet, and who are immediately paying attention and watching that there's suddenly an open Senate seat, and that that's available to us. Otherwise, the general public won't have that opportunity. And frankly, the only reason I'm here is because I read an article in the newspaper. When this candidate who was running got out, the newspaper published it, and then they had an article the next day, and then I had made that decision to run. So it is critical and important that when we consider this, that we are factoring the fact that the public deserves notification, not the members of this body, but the public deserves notification, and they deserve the right to run, and 3 days does not actually give anybody other than seated incumbents or political insiders the ability to file for an office based on this type of calendar. So to Representative Barreto's point, you asked the question about what happens when somebody weeks after this deadline, do they still get 3 days? That is not how we currently would fill that seat, even if somebody who, like if I had decided to drop out, that's not how we would backfill that. I would actually technically still show on the ballot. And then what would happen after that is I would be officially withdrawn. My name wouldn't come off the ballot, especially if ballots are already printed. Then that would go to our party PCP processes, and they would follow the party bylaws and appoint, which is how I got here, because somebody ran through the ballot, his name was on the ballot, withdrew for office, and then the PCPs appointed me to finish running through the general election. So that's how that would happen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Representative Parrish, I don't think you've correctly characterized what happened in Klamath Falls. They organized, and maybe our other witness. I think you'd be surprised at how quickly people in Klamath Falls organized. sitting commissioners, past commissioners, folks. It was really impressive how people quickly organized, and within a day, there were folks who were very eager to respond. And I'd encourage you to look at what happened in Klamath Falls. And I don't think you accurately describe that situation because of, in fact, folks organized a writing campaign pretty quickly. But, and second of all, on your handout, you have this date. Is your 14 days the 14 days after the candidate withdraws, who has previously filed, the incumbent, or the 14 days before the deadline that they have to
file? So the 14, Chair Williamson, Representative McClain, the 14 days, we would move the filing deadline back, and then all of the same deadlines would still exist. So the withdrawal date would then be the current 3 days after filing deadline, but then it opens up a 14-day window from that last filing deadline. So here's the situation that this bill also addresses, was that there was a candidate who was interested in running in another legislative seat this year, and we had a member who pulled out the day after, and there was a late last minute filing. And because of that, one person had already filed, and then the other candidate did not have that opportunity. This bill would have corrected that. That candidate ended up running as a minor party write-in, but the fact is, we know that unless you're like a, you know, Lisa Murkowski and your family's, basically political heir in Alaska, write-in campaigns very rarely work, and especially if they're not funded. We saw in your community, for example, people ran write-in campaigns, and they actually ran as, you know, on the Democratic ticket as Republicans. I think it was very confusing to voters, and so this clears that up. And this also allows for a long enough trigger that in your situation, for example, down in Klamath Falls, had Senator Whitsitt pulled out, and then one of the two House members wanted to run, in that situation, you would have triggered another withdrawal and the opportunity then for folks to kind of rise up and backfill the empty House seat, which that did not happen in this situation because of the way the law currently is. So there are other situations to which a 14-day, maybe not this one specifically that you're referencing, but there were other opportunities in the May primary that were lost by candidates who were iced out by incumbents unfairly.
Okay, so can I do a follow-up?
And if you don't want to vote in Ways and Means, they have a quorum, just so you know.
They do have a quorum?
Yeah, so go ahead.
Is your 14-day, so based on what I'm hearing, you would say that House Bill 2945 addresses the issue of people being iced out, as you referred to. It's just that you want a longer period of time for people to be able to file.
Well, Chair Williamson, Representative McClain, the underlying concept of getting rid of the incumbent protection piece, I am not wedded to the actual mechanism of how that happens, whereas yours is asking us, and I would have a little bit of concern that somehow we're, as incumbents, we are at a disadvantage on a filing deadline, which this bill does. But you'll notice that the next chunk of the bill is actually almost word for word exactly what was in the other House bill. My concern is the ability for people to accurately have an opportunity to respond in their community. That means the press being able to report on it, that people know there is another vacancy, that then from the groundswell, people have the chance to form a PAC, go out and get the materials that they need for their voter's pamphlet. House Bill 2945 also has the issue based on the calendar of, if somebody files and pulls out on the Friday, that with the 63rd day, they've missed a voter's pamphlet opportunity to actually put a voter's pamphlet in. So there's some just technical problems with 2945, the way it's drafted, and it does not account properly for those things. But really, it's about making sure that truly people from the community and not just political insiders have that window to then file for those office because there are people across the board who were in other races in my neck of the woods were very shocked to see folks even pull out even 4 days before. And while people did indeed organize, there was a race last cycle where that did not happen and that candidate was not given fair consideration as a member of the Republican Party. So so I think that a longer time with the ability for the press to accurately report and then give people the a true fair amount of time to open a pack, get their voters pamphlet statement written, go out and seek nominations or endorsements from their people in their community and participate that way is much more fair than 3 days that doesn't allow for even a Sunday news story to go out that a seat
can,
is now
can
open.
Can I follow up? So under your proposed dash one, how would 14 days remedy the voter pamphlet problem when 3 days doesn't?
So if you notice, it says as proposed with dash one amendments and the voter's pamphlet modification. So we'd actually have to modify your bill for the voter's pamphlet. The dash one doesn't. The dash one's just the 14 days. You would need a subsequent amendment to modify the voter's pamphlet problem. But in the way I had drafted the other bill, the House Bill 2429, when a candidate filed and it triggered the 14 days, their voter's pamphlet statement would have been due with their filing on that 14 days. So they'd had a full 14 days to not only just apply, they'd be able to get a pack open and meet that obligation, because when they spend the $750, it triggers a pack filing requirement, and then they also would have been able to turn in their voter's pamphlet statement at the same time, and they would have had a straight two-week window and one deadline to respond to.
And then finally, so what I'm hearing is that would require further modification. So so the 3 versus 14 is not necessarily your fix for a voter's pamphlet statement, but necessarily your view that 3 days isn't only serves political insiders?
Yes, I do believe that it only serves political insiders. So, and maybe not people who want to run from the Senate to the House, but certainly from people who want to run from the House to the Senate, because you already, those individuals who would then want to file when that seat opens up, would be able to get that PAC notice. Otherwise, if we're the only people that know, those of us on the inside are the only people that know in a three-day window because the media hasn't had a chance to properly report or newspaper hasn't had the ability to put that out into the public, and then those deadlines are immediately due, there's no opportunity for a grassroots candidate to actually rise up and do that in a three-day window. Just technically, it's, and again, like I said, even just with the voter's pamphlet issue, technically 3 days doesn't work.
That's 3 business days, actually.
I counted those out and mapped them out for you.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, I don't agree with Representative Parrish. I think our own experience in Klamath Falls disproves her premise. But one thing's for sure is that we did have an example. There is clearly an example when someone withdraws after the deadline, because then everyone is completely barred, versus someone who withdraws before the deadline. So in the distinction, I think what this bill's really saying is it's a 7-day window before the deadline, and then you have it never falls below a minimum of 3. And so it, I guess the issue really comes down to is what, you know, just it's an opinion on how much time people need. In maybe in a metro area, it's harder to get the word out than it is in the more rural districts. But anyway, I think what we have is 7 with a minimum of 3 business days, and trying to recognize that ultimately what we're trying to do is get the voter's pamphlet statement address so that people can file and then get a statement in. As far as raising a campaign committee and doing all the PACs and stuff, those are all details that don't have to be done before a deadline. But I think the two critical things are letting people know an incumbent's not running, and then getting letting those people who file get a statement in the voter's pamphlet. And then I think, as Representative Parrish recognized, her view is that we'd need to change the voter's pamphlet statement. So really the issue comes down to when that deadline needs to be changed based upon a preference of how many days. If you get too long, then you have voter pamphlet statement, you run into logistic issues. And so it's really just coming down to a matter of what's functional. We probably should talk to voter pamphlet publication people about.
It also, Vice Chair McClain, depends on what else's body or what else's body passes, because we've got a bunch of timing bills. So I think we won't have a clear picture until we get a little farther down the road of what else is in the mix.
True.
All right. Thank you, Sal. And Johan Atkinson, I think. We had to lose some folks to vote in Ways and Means, so.
Sure. Gotcha. All right. So I had a presentation up if we can get this started here. And thank
please
you,
say, by say,
Jonah Hackinson. I'm from Klamath Falls. You know that. I've talked to all about half of you. And why I'm calling it the Whitsitt Bills is because in my town, it's called the Whitsitt Maneuver now. You know, it's in the newspaper. It's a headline. They put your picture on it, Mr. McClain, because you are supposedly the one that's solving it. Now, I was up here, as you know, last month for about 9 days talking to a bunch of you guys, right, and including you, about Parrish's bill, because I liked Parrish's bill. And you said you had one in the works. And you said 5 days when I was in your office, and now I realize it might boil down to 3 days. But just for visualization, I have come up with an imaginary month, okay? So the imaginary month in Parrish's scenario would do this. Incumbent withdraws, you got 14 business days to file, right? It's a long time. Seems like it's too long. How dare we? I'm sorry, like this is not going to cause problems with any filing or voters' pamphlets or anything. She's done the work on that, and I know that. Now, I'm not championing her thing any more than I am yours, because I think they're all bad. Because this all adds something about incumbent language that does not currently exist in the statute. Okay. Now, okay, what else could happen in Parrish's bill? Well, this. That's another thing that can happen. Also, not too bad. You got enough time, media cycle, like she was talking about. You guys have already said everything I needed to say. You know, you got more than enough time, standard cycle, and so on. Now, McClain, if I can, answer me this. So this is your proposal.
Can you go ahead and use titles, please?
Yes, yes. Representative McClain.
McClain, thank
yes,
you.
Yes, Vice Chair McClain. If you can answer me this. This is your bill, right? This is what would happen 7 days earlier for an incumbent, right? Different date?
Yes, Madam Chair and Mr. Oakinson, the incumbent would be required to let the public know whether she or he was running 7 days before the filing date.
Okay. So, but they have a different last day to file, though, according to your language.
No.
77th day before instead of the 70th day before.
It would be 7 days before everyone else would need to file.
Which is currently the 70th day before the primary.
Correct.
Okay. All right. So this is a reasonably decent representation of your bill, correct?
Yes.
Okay. But this is also possible.
Let me make sure I'm reading this correctly. The
3 business days.
3 business days if the incumbent withdraws.
If that's later than the normal data file.
If
this is possible.
So in your scenario B,
somebody withdraws on Friday and then.
When did they filed to? So what you're saying is an incumbent filed to run and then withdrew.
Withdrew for on Friday. And then you have 3 days where. The last day to file it, that's all we got. There's 3 days.
Yeah, three. There would be
now,
three
now,
business
to your
days.
Point, and I would like to say this nice thing. Okay, I'm going to say
yeah,
a nice
please,
thing.
Please, say yes. It nicely.
Okay. Representative McClain, Vice Chair, and the Chair, I appreciate your time here. I am from Klamath Falls. I was a candidate last year. You guys know this. This happened underneath me. Now, I was not a partisan candidate. I wasn't. I did not affiliated candidate. I did not participate in the primary. But I watched this happen, and people asked a lot of really strange questions. They couldn't figure out what was going on. Okay? And it took a long time for people to figure out what the current situation is, never mind having to deal with creating these other scenarios. And I appreciate your attempts at trying to make sure it doesn't happen again. I really do. And so I'm bringing it to you, and I'm not saying you're doing anything wrong. You're right. This does, all of these, prevent what we call the Whitsitt maneuver, right, from happening again. It does. But how about this? These are fixed dates, any candidate in the primary, and a fixed date to file. He uses the same amount of the calendar that you guys are using anyway. So if that's not possible, I would. I mean, I know you guys have copies of this. I know you guys have letters, right? All of you, right? From people from Klamath Falls who have told you exactly the same thing I'm telling you now, is that what you're proposing, Mr. McLean, although it's well-intentioned, all right, we want more to make sure this doesn't happen, and we want it fixed so it can't move around. And can't, and here's my reason, if I may. The current scenario is, in my mind, unconstitutional. I don't think we should be granting privileges or making different rules for different people on the same terms that don't apply to other people the same way. That's in our Bill of Rights in the state of Oregon. And at that, I will leave you to the exhibits, the testimony that have been sent to you by people from like Al Schweitzer, Michael Stettler, and so on, that you guys have, right, to review on your own time. Thank you.
So yeah, I have a question of Mr. Hokanson. So you would like 7 days if someone files and then withdraws after filing?
Well, you have a seven-day period before, like that's a stopgap measure. It's like somebody drops out 7 days before, there's an automatic seven-day fixed new filing date, period. So the incumbent withdrawal has nothing to do with it, just any candidate. If the campaign changes in 7 days before, then it's an extra 7 days right there, based on the current existing 70th day before the primary to file. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. No problem.
Chair Williamson, Vice Chair McLean, representatives. My name is Sal Peralta. I'm a resident of McMinnville. I'm here to testify in favor of this legislation. I appreciate the good faith effort from the leadership in both bodies and Representative McLean, your leadership in trying to address this issue. I did just want to briefly state for the record that Representative McLean did mention the situation in Klamath Falls where citizens were able to respond very quickly to the post-deadline withdrawals of the Whitsitts. However, it did take them longer than 3 days to really get organized. And I think that you'll note that the testimony from Al Schweitzer, from the mayor of Klamath Falls, and others who were involved in that all suggested a longer window if possible. And I'm very mindful of the fact that you're running up against deadlines on the voters pamphlet. And so the clerks are going to have challenges getting that published. I think there are other groups additionally, like the League of Women Voters that produces a voters pamphlet, the Independent Party of Oregon that produces a voters pamphlet, that this will also affect their timing and deadlines if you go too long. But I do think that Representative Parrish raised a very strong point when she brought up the issue of newspaper publishing dates, publishing deadlines, and the challenges of just getting the message out. Only so much can happen through word of mouth, and a lot of word of mouth in communities happens through community newspapers still. So I would encourage you, as you look at the calendar, based on the testimony that we've had not only here but what's been submitted in writing, that you try and stretch it out for as long as possible within reason. And again, I do appreciate the effort. This is what happened in Oregon in 2016 has actually caused legislatures in other states to adopt similar legislation, including Utah and other states. Well, they had it previously at your suggestion. So anyway, thank you very much for
Thank you, Madam Chair. At the point that you and Representative McLean and Vice Chair Rayfield decide which bill you want to move, because I think we've had a good illustration of the problem and we're having a good debate about what's the best way to solve it, I have an amendment idea and I want to amend the right bill.
Okay. Great. Yeah.
Well, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Pelletier, for your testimony. It does appear that the goal is ultimately to allow people to file. I think Representative Parrish seemed to imply that 3 days was chosen as some sort of insider gaming, and I'm disappointed in that reference. That's actually not true. The goal was to actually get people into the voter's pamphlet. And so I think once there is a acknowledgement that you can move the voter's pamphlet deadline, and if we're going to do that, then we need to sit down and just figure out what's the best amount of time, recognizing that ultimately we got to bring things to a close and get stuff in a voter's pamphlet. So I'm open to whatever that timeline is, and certainly recognize that, you know, the goal is ultimately to let people have an opportunity to run once an incumbent decides not to run, and we want people to have that.
If I can, Representative McLean, I do not think that you were trying to do anything bad. You know what I mean? I know you guys are all trying to solve a problem, and I'm glad. I was happy to hear anything. And I heard about you having an idea about it before I even heard about Parrish's bill, okay? I think it was Mr. Stetler told me, my friend, and that you were like, we got to do something about this scenario. I mean, I know it's been on your mind. All right. And I know it's not an easy thing because of, you know, other, just like when you change one thing, the whole bureaucracy changes, you know, and we got to make sure we're doing that in a reasonable way. And if we can change the other parts to make it work better at the front end where it's important, I think that's what I would like to say. And I think you would too. All right. I think all of us do. It's a very good, strong bipartisan bill that would make sure our primaries are something that people can trust and not be freaked out about.
All right, thank you all. With that, I will close the hearing on House Bill 2945, and with that, we are adjourned. Thank you all. Thank you all.